Father, we want to thank you for this day. We thank you for revealing yourself to us. And as we begin to look now at the dilemma that our contemporaries are in, we pray that you will give us understanding, that we may really begin to see in a new way just how people around us look at the world and themselves. With understanding, we may have compassion and a desire to communicate more faithfully. We ask it, Father, for Jesus' sake. Amen. Let me just clear this off. So I'm going to need to use the board. Now, today we are going to start looking at some of the ideas in The God Who Is There and Escape from Reason. Those were two foundational books of Schaeffer. Much of what was in those books was the foundation for How Should We Then Live, both as a film series and as a book, years later. Both Escape from Reason and The God Who Was There were published, I suppose, in 67, 68, though they were based on lectures that had been given many years previously in various different forms. I have a copy, for example, of the lectures as they were given at Wheaton College several years earlier, simply called the Wheaton Lectures, and they printed them up for the use of their students, much of the same material that was in those two books. The themes of these books are repeated over and over again in Schaeffer's work, and he comes back to them, really, in his very last book, The Great Evangelical Disaster, in terms of the things that he is describing, warning about, the shift in thinking in our culture. He was very concerned before his death with the way they were, the ways our culture was thinking were increasingly infiltrating the evangelical church. We'll come to that later. He just felt that his warnings were going unheeded. And that's why he wrote that book. As the last book, he just felt a tremendous obligation before God to go around giving the lectures he did in the few months before he died and get that book out. That he had to sound a warning to the evangelical church in terms of where it was going. Now, today, as I said to you, I wanted you to start thinking about the line of despair, what Schaeffer meant by that, because it's foundational to all that he says in relationship to understanding our culture. Now let me start with two introductory points. The first is, why is it important to understand what he calls the line of despair? And there are two answers that he gives to that. One is that we have to understand this in order to communicate to our culture. Because unless we understand the way people around us think, and that their thinking has changed very dramatically, we are going to be, as he says, quote, equipping ourselves to work in a period which no longer exists. In fact, rather than talking to the unbelievers, we'll be simply talking to ourselves, is the way he puts it. I would suggest, even though he wrote those words 23 years ago in The God Who Is There, they are still applicable to the church today, because I think there are still many Christians who don't understand that the culture around us thinks in a very different way from the way we as Christians ought to be thinking. So that's the first point he makes there. Why is this important? We have to understand our culture in order to communicate. Secondly, he suggests, and this is early on in The God Who Is There, that we have to understand this issue in order to be able to resist the spirit of the age for ourselves. It's in that context, you will remember, that he quotes Luther. Let me read this paragraph here. The importance of understanding the chasm to which man's thinking has brought him is not of intellectual value alone, but of spiritual value as well. The Christian is to resist the spirit of the world. But when we say this, we must understand that the world spirit does not always take the same form. So the Christian must resist the spirit of the world in the form it takes in his own generation. If he doesn't do this, he is not resisting the spirit of the world at all. This is especially so for our generation, as the forces at work against us are of such a total nature. It is our generation of Christians, more than any other, who need to heed these words attributed to Martin Luther. If I profess with the loudest voice and clearest exposition every portion of the truth of God, except precisely that little point which the world and the devil are at that moment attacking, I am not confessing Christ, however boldly I may be professing him. Where the battle rages, there the loyalty of the soldier is proved. And to be steady on all the battlefield besides is mere flight and disgrace if he flinches at that point. Now, it's precisely that which caused Schaeffer to speak so strongly in The Great Evangelical Disaster, because he felt that the evangelical church in many places was giving in to the thinking of the culture. It was indeed compromising to the spirit of the age at this very point of what he calls the line of despair. Now, the second introductory remark I want to make is the distinction that he makes between rationalism and rational. It's very important to understand it, because if you don't understand it, you will get confused by when you read Schaeffer as you think about where he stood personally. What is the distinction he makes? Rational, he says, this is page 9, this is in the Collected Works, the Complete Works, volume 1, early on in The God Who Was There. Rational means that the things which are about us are not contrary to reason. Or to put it another way, man's aspiration of reason is valid. And so the Judeo-Christian position is rational. What he means by that is simply that Christianity is reasonable. What it says about the world around us is true, it fits. That human rationality is an important part of the way God has made us. This is tremendously important. It's the point that Paul makes in Acts, where he says to Festus, Festus says to him, Paul, your great learning is driving you mad. And Paul replies, why should you think it unreasonable that God should raise the dead? Paul is teaching a reasonable message. It's a message which makes rational sense. What does Schaeffer mean by rationalism? By rationalism, he means that men and women, beginning by themselves, try to build, by their reason, try to build rationally a system of thought, a means of explaining the world, and everything else. By rationalism, he means what he also uses the term humanism for, secular humanism, that human beings try to build a view of reality simply beginning from themselves, with their own reason, trying to find an answer to the problems that confront them, trying to build meaning and values for themselves by their reason. So by rationalism, he means simply a trust in reason as the resolution to the problems that face us, whether philosophical problems or moral problems. And in that sense, of course, he says Christianity has nothing to do with rationalism, because we begin with God's revelation to us, rather than trying to answer our questions by reason alone. We begin as those who stand before God who has spoken. As he puts it in his title, he is there and he is not silent, the God who exists and who has spoken. He is not silent. He has communicated to us. Now, we defend rationality. We have to read the Bible with our reason. There's no other way to read it. God has given us minds. It has to be read in a normal way. Rationality is absolutely essential. But rationalism is something completely different. Now, what does Schaeffer mean by the line of despair after those two introductory remarks? What does Schaeffer mean by the line of despair? What he suggests is that in about 1890 in Europe and 1935, approximately, and these are only approximate dates, of course, in the United States, the whole way of thinking changed. Now, let me try to draw this for you. I'm sure you've seen these diagrams in his book. Here's the line of despair. He says, above that line, before 1890 in Europe, before 1935 in the United States, people were what he called rationalistic optimists with a unified view of knowledge. Now, what does he mean by that? He means that up until those dates, up until that time, up until really the end of the last century, the early part of this century, depending on where you are and you lived and who you are, it was taken for granted that human beings, by their own understanding, by their reason, would be able to understand life. That there were answers to be found. That truth exists and could be discovered. That moral values exist and can be discovered and can be applied to the individual and society. And that while we may not have all the answers to our questions at the moment, that eventually we would be able to find the answers. So a unified view that everything will actually fit together. That we can have a rational approach to knowledge, to morality, to truth, to meaning and purpose, and to society, and we will find answers. Now, he suggests that after 1890 in Europe and 1935 in the USA, that all of this changed. That now we are living in a very different society where this is no longer taken for granted. That there is now, as he says, no antithesis. What he means by that is that two opposite things can both be true. That there is, to put it another way, relativism with regard to both truth and morals. That now truth is something which is personal. It is something which is true for me, though it may not be true for somebody else. He says, what we're dealing with is a shift in the concept of truth. That with that shift, modern man is born. And that we cannot understand people in our culture, and we will not communicate to them unless we understand that they are now living below the line of despair. That the majority of people we meet have no concept any longer of truth and meaning which can be rationally found, which will answer their questions, which will put everything together. You will remember me quoting in Outreach to Contemporary Culture, Nietzsche's prophecy over 100 years ago, where he says, as soon as these new ideas begin to affect the culture as a whole, what they will produce is a gnawing and crumbling skepticism and relativism. And that's what it means to live below the line of despair, skepticism and relativism. Now, what does Nietzsche mean by that? He knew very well that the ordinary person in the street doesn't say, I don't have a unified view of truth. Doesn't say, I'm no longer a rationalistic optimist. Doesn't say that I've lost antithesis, etc., etc. Nietzsche's point is that the effect on the culture as a whole, as these ideas began to percolate down, would be just to create a general sense of skepticism, of uncertainty about life, a general cynicism. Now, if you go anywhere in Europe, you will find this tremendously powerfully. People don't have to have read philosophy. They don't have to know anything about this discussion. People are simply cynics. Most of the population in France. That's one of the reasons why it's terribly hard to plant a church there. You can be there for 20 years and you maybe end up with 15 people in a church. The culture is deeply cynical. People have no notion whatsoever that there is truth which can be found, and if you try to tell them there is, they simply don't believe you. British society is filled with cynicism. You go to any secondary school, any high school, and you find the teachers are mostly cynics, and most of their students are completely cynical as well, and it affects everything. In most of our schools in Britain, there is no concept whatsoever of the value of working hard, of studying, that there is something to be learned. Cynicism is just a mentality which pervades the schools from top to bottom. Because really, there is nothing which is really worth putting yourself out for. Another way to express it would be to say that there is just apathy. That may ring more of a bell here in the United States, that there is simply apathy. Now, people may agree or disagree with Schaeffer precisely about the way he traces the development of these ideas. Remember, he talks about Kant, and he talks about Hegel, and about Kierkegaard. But whether they disagree about the details, in a way that is simply fiddling while Rome burns, the fact that his outline is unquestionably correct, and that modern man, as he calls it, has been born, that there has been a shift in the concept of truth, is unquestionable. I was saying in apologetics this morning that one of the great problems we face is that many Christians are still not aware of this, that we are, many of us as Christians, living behind a wall, where as believers we are still operating knowing that there is truth which can be found, because we've found him, or he's found us rather, God himself, who is truth, has found us. We are certain that there are answers. We are certain that there is meaning and purpose to our lives. We have no doubt about it. We are absolutely confident that there are sure moral values. This is what Christianity is. It says this is the truth. And that there is a meaning to history, there is a meaning to our lives, that we have hope, etc. But our culture doesn't think that way. It doesn't think that way at all. And much of our communication still assumes that the culture is our side of the wall, that it really understands the way we think. And people simply don't. People simply do not understand. It's a foreign idea to them that there is truth to be found, or that there are moral certainties which apply to everybody in every situation and are always the same. Let me give you just a couple of illustrations of the dilemma we face. One can think of the whole battle between Christians and others over the whole abortion issue, the pro-life and the pro-choice groups. You have to understand that what is taking place is people really throwing slogans at each other which neither of them understand. We talk about being pro-life, and indeed we are. Because for us who believe that human beings are made in the image of God, human life has an absolute value. And clearly, the fetus in the womb is a human life. It's not anything else. And we assume that everybody ought to agree with us that this is a human life, and therefore it has absolute value. The people on the other side of the wall have as their fundamental value personal choice. That the individual should be free to do what they want to do. That is their moral certainty. And if we just shout at them louder, they won't understand us any better. Somehow we have to get to the point of actually trying to communicate with people. Because otherwise we're just throwing bricks over the wall from one side to the other. Now that issue, I think, illustrates the problem. That there's almost no dialogue between Christians and non-Christians on this issue. There is simply confrontation. And actually, the confrontation, we are passing each other.
Yeah. These
yeah, there certainly is. I'm not saying that dialogue is impossible, but simply by shouting loudly what we think will not initiate the dialogue. It simply isn't understood. Because we appear to be threatening what is basic to so many people today, which is that people have a right to choose for themselves, the right to privacy, however it's expressed. You see, and I think we're always amazed how our culture has changed. We were talking about this early this morning, Clay, but just before lunch. But when you think of the law case that was it Cincinnati? Yeah, over the exhibit of Robert Mapplethorpe's photographs. I think most Christians were probably astonished by the outcome of the trial. Because if you, like I, had read the account of what the content of the photographs actually was, there is no question whatsoever that they were obscene on any definition of obscenity. But there was no conviction in the trial. The gallery was acquitted. Now, there are all sorts of reasons for it, but the fundamental one is we are living in a situation where there is no sense of absolute moral values. You can talk about community standards, but they are constantly changing. That won't help you at all. And the real issue, and the defense lawyers exploited it absolutely to the full, was that these photographs were an authentication of Robert Mapplethorpe's life. Of his lifestyle as a homosexual who was dying of AIDS. That they expressed something about that sincerely and authentically. But that was the convincing issue. That an individual was able to express themselves, to authenticate themselves by their expression, by their photographs. And it's a thoroughly existentialist argument. But it won the day. And this ordinary jury of ordinary men and women were convinced by it. And I think most Christians were horrified. How could that possibly happen in America in 1990, I think, was the response of most Christians. Well, if we don't understand that it happens and why it happens, we haven't understood what Schaeffer's talking about here. The whole concept of truth has changed in our culture. The whole concept that there are certain moral values which everybody understands and accepts and which everybody can find if they just look hard enough, has disappeared. That's not where we are anymore. Now, the most obvious area where it's true, and that's why I've used this example here from the Post-Dispatch, because this is at a very ordinary kind of everyday level. If you look at the third paragraph from the bottom, this is a father answering his child's question, "Daddy, who is God?" And he doesn't really know how to answer the child. And he says, if you notice there, he says, "What was so difficult about the question was that it required me to lie." It's amazing that he'd even use that word, actually. It shows that he's still wrestling with the older view, that he would even use that word. The God of a four-year-old and the God of a 40-year-old cannot be the same. To inflict mine on him would not be just disillusioning, but disorienting. I owed him, I figured, not the truth as I know it, but as I knew it once. I offered him the God of my childhood. The colloquy lasted only a few minutes, thank God. It ended when I informed him that God not only created the world, but cares about it, a proposition of which the adult in me is radically unconvinced. Daniel came back with why. Desperate for an exit, I was visited with inspiration, for the same reason that mummies and daddies love their children. He appeared satisfied and turned to talk of dinosaurs. Back on safe ground, I resumed speaking the absolute truth. Now, see, for most people, like this man, they still think that they've only lost truth, or the certainty of knowledge, in what we might call the area of religion. You know, I have tried to say to you over and over again in class that people around us don't have any notion that we are claiming that Christianity is true, objectively, actually true. They don't have any notion of that. This article is a very good illustration of that. Everybody has their own truth about God. The God of a four-year-old cannot be the same as the God of a 40-year-old. You know, what is true for me is quite different from what is true for my son. 150 years ago, it would have been nonsense to talk that way. It would have really been nonsense to talk that way. People would have wondered what on earth you were saying to speak that way. But that is the way almost everybody speaks. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, it is interesting. I think people, you see, what people are trying to do is still maintain some areas of their knowledge which are certain. They think that this is something which just applies to religion. In fact, it applies to everything. Partly, I would say yes. Because I'm sure he knows very well that what he can say about dinosaurs is partly research and is partly speculation, hypothesis. Yeah, I don't know whether he's aware of that, because as you read the article, it seems like he wants to make a distinction between religious truth and other kinds of truth. Perhaps they're still possible in other areas, but that distinction disappeared a very long time ago in philosophy. Well, you can get that by looking in his book in terms of what events he appeals to. In fact, he talks about things before that time in both. I think he's chosen those dates as saying those are moments when it wasn't just an individual here and there, but the shift began to affect the culture as a whole. In the class on Schaeffer's early years, we came across a little pamphlet he wrote here in St. Louis, I think in 1945. Was it 45? 44? Sin is Normal. It was written here, anyway, in St. Louis. And it's very interesting because he's looking at that issue of moral relativism there. It was after the first Kinsey report was published, which was simply describing the moral behavior of Americans and saying, well, then that should be the law, what they do. The whole notion of sociological law, or that the laws of this country should be based on the behavior of the citizens, which is again a radically new idea. And at the time, I'm sure that wasn't something that most evangelical pastors were talking about or responding to, because many of us are still only waking up to the notion that we live in a society that's changed. But I think what he is saying is that, you see, he refers to the Armory Show back in 1913, this art exhibit, and says that was a point where in art in the United States there was a radical change in this way of thinking. That was what he calls below the line of despair. So he's not saying that this thinking didn't exist at all before 1935, but that it becomes what we might call a whole cultural shift at that point. And the same in Europe in 1890. If you look at some of the examples I've got here, that's why I've chosen some from the 19th and some from the 20th century. If you look, for example, at the two by Thomas Hardy in Tenebris, and The Darkling Thrush. Now, how many of you have read any of Hardy's novels? Jude the Obscure, The Mayor of Casterbridge, Tessa the D'Urbervilles, etc. Well, quite a few of you. Well, if you remember reading Hardy, and Hardy is writing in the middle of the 19th century, 1850s, 1860s, 1860s, I suppose, yeah, 1850s, right up till 1930, lived to be an old man. He died in his 80s, I guess, but was beginning to write in the 60s and 70s, 1860s and 70s. If you're familiar with his novels, you'll remember that they are filled with a sense of unease, of the melancholy nature of human existence, of the sense of foreboding about the future. There's a very famous line at the end of Tessa the D'Urbervilles, where after she is executed at Winchester Prison for murdering her appalling husband, Hardy has this line that, what is it exactly? He says, the chief of the immortals had finished his sport with Tess. Finally, God had stopped playing with her. I mean, that's what he's saying. Not that he believed in God, but in terms of... let me just read something that's written about Hardy in this book of his poems. He says, his work is concerned mainly with suffering, and in particular with the human sense of impotence in the face of a ruthless destiny. He described himself as an agnostic, but he was in many ways closer to being an atheist, combining disbelief in God with a venomous dislike of him for not existing. The strength of his work comes mainly from a tragic stoicism, a blind will to go on living in despite of the malignancy of fate. Now, you see this sense of just a total hopelessness of the human condition. If you look at these two poems I have chosen here, both of them have the theme that there is no hope at all for the human person. The one from The Thrush, The Darkling Thrush. I leant upon a coppice gate when frost was spectre grey, and winter's dregs made desolate the weakening eye of day. The tangled vine stems scored the sky like strings of broken lyres, and all mankind that haunted nigh had sought their household fires. The land's sharp features seemed to be the century's corpse at Lent, his crypt the cloudy canopy, the wind his death lament. The ancient pulse of German birth was shrunken hard and dry, and every spirit upon earth seemed fervorless as I. At once a voice arose among the bleak twigs overhead, in a full-hearted evensong of joy illimited. An aged thrush, frail, gaunt, and small, in blast-beruffled plume, had chosen thus to fling his soul upon the growing gloom. So little cause for carolings of such ecstatic sand was written on terrestrial things, afar or nigh around, that I could think there trembled through his happy good-night air some blessed hope whereof he knew and I was unaware. The other poem finishes in just the same way. In fact, that the other one just all the way through describes over and over again the hopelessness of his existence, that he is living in darkness. Winter time nighs, but my bereavement pain it cannot bring again. Twice no one dies. Flower petals flee, but since it once hath been no more, that severing scene can harrow me. Birds faint in dread, I shall not lose old strength in the lone frost's black length, strength long since fled. Leaves freeze to dun, but friends cannot turn cold this season as of old for him with none. Tempests may scathe, but love cannot make smart again this year his heart who no heart hath. Black is night's cope, but death will not appall one who past doubtings all waits in unhope. He is describing himself as in a position now where there is no hope at all anymore. There isn't even in the possibility of hoping for hope. And even in a situation where even pain can't hurt him anymore, because he's already been so destroyed by the emptiness and absurdity of his existence that he doesn't even get hurt anymore. That's what this writer meant by stoicism in the hands of a malignant fate. But not stoicism created by either hope or by courage, but of being so abused that there was nothing left to abuse any longer. Now there's somebody writing in the 1860s, 1870s. What's interesting is that these poems which he wrote were not popular at the time. He stopped trying to get his poetry published because magazine editors didn't like it. And I think because it was so pessimistic, because he was in a way sort of ahead of his age, it wasn't until much later that many of his poems were published and began to get a bigger and bigger audience. And today you'll find many critics who will say that Hardy will be remembered as a poet rather than a novelist. Though at the time his novels were widely read, and they've always been considered his classic works. Today you hear an increasingly stronger voice saying his greatest work is his poetry, because it speaks directly to our age today, and people understand it immediately, and it fits with where they are.
And the same thing happened with Emily Dickinson?
Mm-hmm.
But posthumously, it wasn't until the 20s or 30s, 1920s, 30s, that she was accepted.
Yes. Yeah, here you've got somebody who's writing before the time which Schaefer describes, 1890 in Europe. Or if we were to look at Stephen Crane, you've got somebody who's doing that in the 1890s here in the States. Schaefer speaks about 1935. He isn't saying that there weren't people earlier. He's talking about the way the culture as a whole moved. And Stephen Crane was tremendously popular in the 60s and 70s. Now, 70 or 80 years after he wrote these things, let me just read one of them here, and then we must stop because we're going over time. On this page of Stephen Crane's poems, Some of the Black Riders, I remember reading this poem as a non-Christian, and it described exactly where I felt. This was in 1965. It became almost a kind of a badge for me. It actually comes from that book, The Red Badge of Courage, and his Civil War description and other stories and poems. But this poem was kind of like a badge in terms of describing what I felt and just the cynicism which is expressed in it. Let's just look at this one. It's the second one here. God fashioned the ship of the world carefully. With the infinite skill of an all-master made he the hull and the sails, held he the rudder ready for adjustment. Erect stood he, scanning his work proudly. Then at fateful time a wrong called, and God turned heeding. Lo, the ship at this opportunity slipped slyly, making cunning, noiseless travel down the ways, so that forever rudderless it went upon the seas, going ridiculous voyages, making quaint progress, turning us with serious purpose before stupid winds. And there were many in the sky who laughed at this thing. Very similar to the end of Tessa the D'Urbervilles in some ways, but he doesn't believe in God. But he's using this image to describe the meaninglessness of human existence, of human history, and of what is happening in this universe.